Hello and welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 565. On the line from the UK, we have Mr. Dave Neal. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Andrew. How are you, mate?
I'm very good, thank you. Thanks again for sort of stepping in at the last minute here. I had hoped to do the show with Len, so we could talk about World Superbike from this weekend from Laguna Seca. Len, though, had a business trip, was out of town, and I think is either, if not, he's not in midair, he's probably landing at Dallas. So I knew that I was also wanting to do the catch-up with British Superbikes from Saturday, so I contacted Dave and see if he'd do the two together, and he was kind enough to agree. So thanks again.
Absolutely, my pleasure. It's always good to be on the show and good to be on with yourself. I'm looking forward to covering World Superbikes, BSB, and a little bit of news that we've got on the show. I think we'll maybe give World Superbikes slightly less coverage than British Superbikes. It was a bit of a toughie from Laguna Seca. We'll come to that shortly. We'll have a look at the news first.
Yeah, so there was a little bit of news. I think, actually, the last couple of weeks or so has been a little bit quiet for real hardcore news, but there was definitely the rumour mill. So I think at some point that, you know, it starts with the rumours and then the rumours start to congeal into news. And I think maybe that's what we can talk about. And it sounds like Danny Pedrosa will be on the grid for 2019. The rumours that have been floating around now are attracting more and more substance. It sounds like a combination of a sponsorship deal between the Sepang International Circuit and Petronas is coming together. It sounds like they will be taking two of the satellite Yamahas, and it sounds like they're going to be fairly high-specced satellite Yamahas as well. So if not full factory, at least fairly kind of late 2018, 2019. And it sounds like they'll be coming to the grid by buying out the two grid spots from the Aspar team, which is the Angel Nieto team. He, I know, has been having some financial difficulties, and I think this is a solution for him to get a chunk of cash that will probably help from that standpoint. And that way, the new Petronas Sepang International Circuit team, I'm not quite sure what the name is going to be as yet, but they will then get to own those grid slots and operate independently.
Yeah, I mean, the team itself, the Johan Stigerfeld team, the SIC, they're growing pretty quickly from what started off as a Moto3 team. Obviously, they've got Ayumu Sasaki and Adam Noradin on the beautifully painted Petronas bikes. Then they've taken the step into Moto2 this year, and then to take the step into to MotoGP on a third season in succession. They're quite big steps for a team to take, but obviously they have the resources, and having Petronas throw as many dollars as they possibly can at the deal, they have some of the best backing around from the Far East. So it'll be great to see what they can do. If it's Danny and if it's Frankie Morbidelli, then fantastic. That would work really well for them. We need to see Danny still on the grid. Of course we do. He's too young to hang his leathers up just yet. I think there may be other riders that will be hanging their leathers up at the end of the season at this point. That we'll come on to in a little bit of time. But yeah, that's a good one. It's, as you say, it's been bubbling around for quite a while now, and even more so since the Tech 3 team took on the KTMs, leaving Yamaha behind. So it's nice to finally get some kind of confirmation through Moto Matters. It's not officially been announced yet, but it's looking as though that will be the case.
Yeah, and I think the sense is too that they will be a competitive team. Danny is not really likely to sign for anything that isn't going to be fairly close to full factory. I've understood because the team is very well financed. They are prepared to pay the higher price that Yamaha is asking to get the higher spec satellite bikes. This was something, you know, Tech 3 in some respects were always chafing at the bit, hoping to get better bikes, better updates throughout their year. But, you know, they weren't necessarily paying what Yamaha was asking. So therefore, that seemed to be a sort of a restriction on their supply. So, you know, this could be a competitive package. The only question I do have about that is, as I understand it, with the tyres that they've had this year, one of the issues Danny has had riding the Honda has been getting heat specifically into the rear tyre throughout the race. This has been an issue for him. And the Yamahas, as I understand it, you know, I often hear Rossi and Vinales to a degree, they themselves are complaining that they're struggling with rear traction issues on that bike too. So although, you know, I think Danny's style will certainly suit the fast-flowing Yamahas, I'm wondering if he's going to continue to have issues with the tyres and getting heat into them.
I think whatever Danny Pedrosa rides, he may well struggle to get heat into the Michelin rear. Maybe the Bridgestone kept its heat better for him. And he just seems to have struggled that little bit since Michelin came into the series. So, yeah, it seems to be an ongoing issue for Danny. So I think regardless of what he rides, the nature of MotoGP and the Michelin tyres at the moment mean that, yeah, he possibly will struggle. Let's see what Michelin bring next year. They may bring a different compound altogether that keeps its heat. Because obviously Yamaha, as you rightly say, have been complaining of rear grip. It's something that maybe will be addressed in the off season and through R&D. But I would like to see Danny do well. I still think he could make it into the top five on a reasonable package. As we said about Tech 3, the continued support through the season, I don't think was there for them. I'm sure I read this week that at the end of the season, the bikes are wheeled out next door from the Yamaha factory squad into the Tech 3 squad, and apart from the odd couple of spares, that is the bike for the season. They don't tend to get upgrades per se, so it's run what you brung all year apart from replacement spares. So yeah, if Petronas can throw a few more dollars at it than Monster did with DeWalt and the other sponsors for Tech 3, then yes, they will be on a slightly more superior package to what Hervé Poncharal could put out.
And then also the rumour is with Franco Morbidelli coming across in the Mark VDS team, it sounds like, from what I've understood, that they're going to concentrate, or Van der Straten, essentially the team owner now, is going to concentrate primarily on Moto2, not necessarily thinking that the bigger MotoGP investment is giving him the return, especially with the satellite Hondas. It's been a struggle for pretty much anybody riding those bikes. That does, in theory, leave two grid spots available. I don't know if there will be a deal forthcoming, but I haven't heard any rumours to hear that you know, there could be another two bikes like those Ducatis that go from Aspar to some other team. So that completely unknown.
It is indeed. As for Mark VDS, yeah, with everything that's gone on this season, with the difficulties that the team have faced in losing Michael Bartolomei, obviously Ian Wheeler as well, and the rider coach Stefan Prine, it's really put the team on the back foot. They haven't had the returns that they would hope for. Who knows what should have, would have, could have happened if the team had stayed together, and what the plans potentially were prior to the Mark VDS team having the issues that they've had. So, yeah, it would be fair to say that Mr. Van der Straten hasn't had the returns he would have liked, but they've nurtured some fantastic talent through Jack Miller. Scott Redden hasn't quite hit the mark that he maybe could have done. If rumours were to be believed, they've got their eyes on Joanne Mir, and trying to bring riders through in a similar way to the VR46 Academy. And obviously they had the connection with the Monlau effort as well. So they were a very, very, very well set up team. And that hopefully will continue through Moto3 and Moto2, just not with that extra step into MotoGP. As far as the two grid slots, that could be anybody's guess. It's too early, they say, for a VR46 squad. So the slots would need to be filled somehow, but at this point in time, I don't know who, what, when, where, or why.
Yeah, and then the other Mark VDS rider is the Swiss rider Tom Luthi. Indications seem to be that he'll be looking to go back down to Moto2, I think, for next year. Although I also know too that one of his primary sponsors is the Interwetten, which is an online gambling company, and there were some changes, recent changes to the Swiss law to do with online gambling crossing borders. I think saying that that has to be now a Swiss company. So there was also a rumor, at least in some of the Swiss newspapers, that he may lose Interwitten as a backer, which may make it difficult for him to then find a good seat in Moto2.
It would. They're not cheap. They're certainly maybe less cheaper than they are, or they're more cheaper, should I say, than they are in MotoGP. It's been mentioned many a time that he's obviously paying for the ride at Mark VDS, which is an awful lot of money, and losing a big backer like that, yeah, it's going to leave him a little bit out of pocket. And to be fair, I think a step back to Moto2 would work for him. It hasn't quite worked in MotoGP. So the best thing is to take a deep breath, take a step back, hopefully find some better backing that will allow him to continue to race, should he lose the Interwetten sponsorship, and go and make his mark back in there, regroup, reset, and try again, and hopefully it will lead to another opportunity. But as we know with MotoGP, second chances don't come around too often.
No, agreed. And Tom, for me too, I think was one of those riders who may have arguably spent too long in Moto2. And I think maybe his riding style is just too ingrained. I think on the counterpoint, you can definitely point to people maybe and make the argument that, come through Moto2 as quickly as possible if your goal is to ride a MotoGP bike. I think in large respects, their riding style is completely different.
And it is.
And I think for Tom, I think he perfected a Moto2 riding style, which is what made him so competitive.
Smooth on one, wasn't he?
Yeah, but I think that caused him problems, and especially having to adapt to what we know, like as everyone has had difficulty with the satellite Hondas. I'd like to have seen Mark VDS continue with the Hondas next year, because my hope was the Honda that they have this year is clearly a better bike than previous Hondas, and then they would have had that next year, and maybe, Franco and Tom may have been able to do something with that, but I don't think that's going to happen.
No, it's not looking likely, is it, at all? Which is a disappointment. And you mentioned Scott Redding there. Crash.net are reporting that Aprilia's technical chief, Romano Albesiano, would like to retain Scott Redding as a test rider for 2019. He also said that the chance to sign Andrea Iannone was too good a chance to pass up. We'll see how that changes into next season. As Iannone gets comfortable on the Aprilia, see if his opinion on that changes. But yeah, Scott was on social media this afternoon asking, is it time to become a test rider, or do I really want to become a test rider? And seeing what the responses were, for me, I don't know. Could he get a decent ride in World Superbikes? Are there any decent seats available in World Superbikes for a start?
Well, currently, I think the only one that you could point to might be the second seat at KRT, but we'll talk about it a little bit later. There are a few other people rumoured to be in the frame for that seat.
Indeed. But yeah, it's a conundrum for Scott Redding as much as it is for Bradley Smith as well. You know, where are these guys going to end up? Because there aren't the MotoGP seat, or as we've, just to contradict myself, that there are potentially two grid spots awaiting. I don't see the two Brits being in the same team. We also, as yet, don't know what's happening with Michael Bartolomei and with his connections and being cleared of any perceived issues that were reported. He's been cleared of those, so that the path is set for him to make a return to MotoGP should he want to. After all, he's been in motorcycle racing for an awful lot of years. Should Michael Bartolomei come back, you would think there may be an option for Scott Redding to go in as a number two rider there to take on if they took on a two-man team. So that could be an option. It's not improbable that you could see Smith and Redding in the same team, or somebody coming up from Moto2. There's lots and lots of permutations, as we know. It would be interesting to see what's going to happen to those two. At the moment, it's all up in the air for both the British riders. It would be a shame to lose them both. But time goes on. There's some hungry young kids coming through. And as you said about going through Moto3, Moto2 as quickly as possible into MotoGP, if you're fast enough, you're good enough, and there's some kids coming through, kids in relative terms, that there's some kids coming through that really genuinely are fast enough. Your likes of Banyaya and Joanne Mir coming through. And there's guys that are following them through. I expect Nicola Bulliger to come through at some point. A lot of the VR46 Academy riders, Lorenzo Baldassari, he'll be looking to make a move up at some point soon. So many, Marco Bezzecchi, there's so many fast young riders looking to fast track through into MotoGP that at some point there aren't going to be enough seats for them. So they may have elongated stays in Moto2, but we'll have to wait and see on that. But the talent pipeline is as healthy as I think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, and I think really that's where a lot of the teams are going to be doing their recruitment. I think Bradley was in line for the seat that Danny took as a hedge, essentially. If Danny hadn't taken that seat or had retired, then I think the offer was going to go to Brad. It sounds like, unfortunately, he's out. And I think the issue with Scott is there's this sense that they're sort of known quantities. And I think it's difficult for sponsors and new sponsors to get excited about them compared to some of these new up-and-coming talents. These, you know, potential, you know, these are people that you can get a real buzz. Oh, they could do this, they could do that. You know, it's sort of these big unknowns. And I think sometimes for some of the sponsors, that is more exciting than having someone who's sort of a known quantity, whether they're good, average, or whatever. I think sometimes there's a bit of a buzz for these teams coming up, and I think the sponsors are more likely to gravitate to the noise that's being raised by some by some Moto2, Moto3 up and comer. Unfortunately, than some of the sort of steady hands of the mature riders at the top.
And from a marketing perspective, the younger following that they bring as well. Yeah. And that it's a new market for a lot of the teams. And, you know, Scott's been in MotoGP since, was it 2014 he came up? 2015, I can't remember. 2014, I think. Everybody has a shelf life in MotoGP to be able to make their mark. Yes, you need to be on a specific bike to be able to challenge for the podium and for top six places. But to be a regular top 10 runner, that's not quite as big an ask as regards to finishing the top six where the factory bikes are. So you would hope that a regular rider that finishes late top 10, you know, your Alvaro Bautistas of this world, how long's he been in MotoGP now? And he seems to, you know, he's a perennial runner now in MotoGP. For how long, I don't know, but he's there. And he's invariably there on merit. We've had these conversations on the show many a time of it's not just about the top six. There are other guys out there fighting for their careers, but there's almost, as there is in football, in the Premiership, in the UK, you have your top six or eight teams and you have everybody else. And they're all fighting for their own mini league, if you like, the same way that almost any motorcycle racing series has. You have the factory guys and you have the best of the rest. And for you to be the best of the rest on a regular basis will keep you in a ride because it keeps the team visible, if you like. Whether you're best independent rider, which is always difficult against the Tech 3 boys and the LCR of Cal Crutchlow, which isn't really that independent, is it? It's a full factory bike.
It is now, yeah.
It is now. They think it's all over. It is now. if you're a German football fan, anyway.
But for a time there, I mean, I think I remember hearing Cal was literally going up to the boss Lucio, and literally saying like, you know, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to go out and ride for the best finish, or do you just want a win it and bin it approach? And Lucio's like, win it and bin it.
Yeah,
you know,
it's absolutely.
Like, that's what's
going to
get
approach.
Us the TV cameras on you. That's what's going to get us the press coverage.
Of course, it is.
You know, whether we finish sixth in overall in the championship or fourth, it doesn't really make any. Necessary
that's
difference
the point
or something like this.
Unless they get prize money for a certain position, which I don't know if
at
they,
the end of the year I think it, they do but,
in
yeah.
a similar way to the football league does. So the difference between finishing sixth and eighth isn't going to be a great deal, I would hazard a guess at. So yeah, get us the coverage, get towards the front. If you crash, okay, don't hurt yourself, but we're going to get great. There's no such thing as bad press in motorcycle racing within reason.
So that was some of the MotoGP news. I don't think it's news. It's rumours. Whatever. Anyway, it's good talking points. There was some good stuff too from the World Superbikes from Nogueira Seca as well. We had a new rider, Carol Haneker, making his World Superbike debut at Nogueira Seca. He was riding for the Gandolini Yamaha team. Andrei Jezek.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Czech rider and the team parted ways after Bruno. I think there was some upset from that because I believe Andre had came across saying, look, you know, I'd paid like 95% of the funds for a year of racing and I barely got half a year from this. So clearly from his standpoint, I still think he thought that was early days to part. But now the team have taken up Carol Haneker.
Which is unusual because normally riders pay in installments. Over 3 periods or 4 periods, something like that. So if things do go wrong, they're not wildly out of pocket. So that's unusual that he's paid for the full season up front and not something I would recommend to anybody, especially in a satellite team, in a smaller privateer team, not a satellite team, privateer team.
Yeah, but I can imagine too, you know, with the team saying like, you know, oh, we've got a few other people in the frame here, you know, if you could see your way clear to deposit, you know, your funds up front, we think you might get it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
well, it's if you just pay part for of the gamble, front, I think
it really is, and at the level of privateer World Superbike teams and World Supersport teams and many others, I'm sure it's a gamble anyway for a lot of them.
I think it's a pretty tenuous existence.
It really is. But they get to race. It's very, very expensive, but they get to race and live out their dream. But yeah, interesting to see Carol Haneker in there, the sort of forgotten man of Moto 3. After winning the Red Bull Rookies Championship in 2013, no, I didn't have to look that up.
That's impressive.
It's the same year that that Jordan Weaving did it. So I was at Misano when he won it. So that's the only reason why I remember. He got a ride, I think, for 2 seasons with the Red Bull KTM team and just didn't cut it. Whatever happened, he just did not cut the mustard. He was outstanding in Red Bull Rookies. He was almost untouchable and was hailed as the next big thing. But unfortunately, the young Czech fella, he just never really made it happen. He was more famous for having long hair than his actual riding talent in Moto3 GP. So very disappointing for him to not make the grade there and to have to come in as a stand-in rider for a privateer World Superbike team. Although I do believe he's been doing some world endurance racing in between. So he's still been racing. But just not at the level that it was hoped he would make it to.
So some of the other rumours, and we touched on this earlier, that there is almost certainly now going to be a seat available at the Kawasaki Racing Team, because it seems almost certain that Tom Sykes will be leaving at the end of the year. Nothing official has been announced or confirmed, but I don't know if you happened to catch an interview with Tom and Charlie Hiscock on the Eurosport just before the race went over the weekend.
You think it's almost certain that he's not going to be there?
Well, he sort of backtracked afterwards saying like, what did I say? I didn't say anything bad. I just kind of said how it was. But
if Tom Sykes is on a factory Kawasaki next season, I shall bare my backside in Woolworth's window.
Oh, I was rather hoping I could just buy you a hat to eat. But okay, if you feel the need...
I am not David Emmett. I have no hat to eat. No, after that interview was incredible. First of all, chapeau, as we talk about hats, chapeau to Charlie Hiscott. What a fantastic pair of interviews with Jonathan Ray and with Tom Sykes to get to the bottom of the bitterness and discord within the KRT team.
So he interviews Tom, he interviews Johnny about the incident at Bruno.
Yes.
And of course, you know, Johnny's saying, well, I think it's Tom's fault. Tom was saying, well, I don't think I was at fault. I think it was a racing incident. So there was that element to it. And I don't think any of that was necessarily controversial or any surprise. But I think Tom did go on to say that from his standpoint, the source of all the bad feeling and the source of all the issues within his time with KRT was not Jonathan or Jonathan's arrival, but in actual fact predates that and is based on Johnny's crew chief now, Pierre Ribot.
Yeah, And that's something that really was a surprise to a lot of people who were expecting him to say, oh, I don't get on with Johnny. Johnny's this, that, and the other. And it was expected that his vitriol would be aimed more at Johnny than anybody else. But it actually isn't. As you say, it's Perry Reba that he saved the most stick for. And, you know, Perry Reba hasn't come out with a response. He's had a right to reply and he's declined it. So we only have one side of the story at the moment. And Tom gets a hard time anyway as a whinger, especially on social media, when you have a look at what riders have said and the responses that people give. So it's difficult to put into context what he said. But yes, he blames Perry Reba for setup. He blames Perry Reba for the issues that he's had within Kawasaki. So if you come out and point the finger at the boss like that, that's akin to Maverick Vinales pointing the finger at Lynn Jarvis, almost. You know, Perry Reba basically runs the team. Lynn Jarvis runs the factory Yamaha squad, so it's almost on a similar level to that. So you would imagine that he wouldn't be riding for them next year if he come out and say the boss, for want of a better word, he's basically called the boss a dick.
So then the rumours have started, and we've already heard rumours, I think, of Mark Vandermark coming across to KRT, but that seems to be firming up that both he and Alex will be re-signing for Yamaha. So the strong rumour I've heard is Liam Haslam from BSB fame will potentially be in the line for the second seat at KRT.
That's gathering more and more momentum as time passes. It's no secret that Leon had discussions with Manuel Pochetti to go to Pochetti Racing. Toprak has obviously already signed on for next year. So that's one seat that he isn't going to get. But since then, yeah, as you rightly say, Leon has been put into the frame, and it hasn't been denied by KRT that they've been in talks with him. And I think that the longer this goes on, the more likely it will be. I mean, I suspect his wages in general wouldn't be that much more than what he would get in BSB. If you look at win bonuses and podium bonuses, championship bonuses, things like that, I don't think it would be a significant difference in financial package. But as a Kawasaki factory rider, the opportunities thereon are almost unlimited compared to being a factory supported rider. Although he is a Kawasaki signed rider.
But I think it's in it with like Kawasaki Europe.
I think it is. It's with Kawasaki Europe rather than Kawasaki Japan, where Jonathan signed with. So yeah. Big difference if you're signed to the factory. It's almost like being signed to Honda Europe rather than HRC, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. As was my understanding, I thought like it was either Kawasaki Europe or Kawasaki UK, but I knew that they were sort of supporting and pushing him, helped him with obviously helping him finding a place back with Kawasaki when he came back from World Superbike into BSB, and then giving him opportunities, you know, with his wild cards that he did like at Donington as well. It seems a completely logical progression. I think most people right now would probably say he's odds on to take the BSB championship this year. And so there's a logical progression for him going with Kawasaki as a BSB champion. I know I'm speaking ahead of, you know, sort of...
No, it's part of the conversation.
But I think it's that's sort of a reasonable forecast. And then he sort of goes up to the team. The question is, though, it's like I can't see him... you know, I could see him being a great number two, but I can't realistically see him bringing the fight to Johnny Ray.
I don't see anybody at this point bringing the fight to Jonathan Ray unless something, you know, unless that V4 Ducati is going to be something a little bit special. And that was another point that Charlie Hiscott did. What was his name? Who was the guy who used to run the Ducati course team?
Oh, Ernesto. Fella. Ernesto Marinelli?
Who left at the end of last season.
Yeah, Ernesto.
Oh, for goodness sake. I can see his face.
Ernesto Marinelli.
No, he was at Brands Hatch at the end of last season to see Shaky take the championship. And he was, anyway, the guy's name, I've been up since 4:45, so dear listeners, and it's currently 22 minutes past nine in the evening, so do forgive me, listeners. He was the boss of Ducati last year, and Charlie did ask him the pointed question, has development of the Ducati Panigale now stopped? Pointing out the fact that Chaz and Marco Melandri are now struggling this season more mm-hmm. than they did last season. And he really tried his best not to answer the question, but kind of did and sort of intimated that, yes, it had slowed down because they're moving all the resources possible into the V4. And he now works for Termignoni Exhausts, who are also developing the exhausts for the new V4, as well as obviously what they've done for Ducati over the years since the 916 and before. That's really going to annoy me now, his name. But anyway, that was, again, Charlie Hiscott's pointed question. So, yes, possibly the development on the Ducatis has tapered off slightly. But yeah, I could see Leon Haslam there. But where Tom Sykes would go, that would mean there would have to be a vacancy somewhere else. Possibly Honda. Could we see Jake Gagne getting a second year? I don't know. A second seat at Honda alongside...
We're just full rumour flow. Cam Beaubier coming across into Honda was a
okay, there's
I
another
heard.
One.
They're really keen to have an American.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah, with the Red Bull back in as well, that would make sense. I would like to see that because he's been lauded for quite a few years now. And, you know, he's a hell of a rider. I don't think he's had the opportunities that he maybe would have liked. If I remember, hasn't he ridden the Tenkate bike or he's had wild cars or he's had stand-in rides? I seem to remember he... was maybe on it at Donington at some point. Maybe he was on the Tenkate bike. I don't know. Again, it's been an awfully long day.
I know, we're skating on thin ice. I think we should just move on. All these people with their hands in their head going, oh my God.
Get on with it.
Okay, so the last little bit of World Superbike news. Has now been confirmed that there will be an Argentinian race on the calendar for 2019 at the new El Villicum circuit in San Juan near the Andes. I think it's going to be quite a haul to get the teams out there. So I know some of the teams who are likely on the hook for some of the expense of moving men and machinery and equipment and out there, not happy about that. I haven't actually looked at next year's calendar to see how that works out, if it's sort of conveniently located that they'll go to the US, but not in October. So that looks like there's going to be one big flight over to the US and then back again, and then presumably another one over to South America.
Yeah, you would think that they would try and link them together as they do in MotoGP, but we'll see how that forms later in the year, I am sure. One quick note of errata from the previous episode. Jeff Bertrand, he wrote into the show, motopod@motopodcast.com. For any of you guys that like to write in, that gets to all of the hosts and invariably invokes a reply. motopod@motopodcast.com, as Jeff Bertrand did. The guys last week were talking about Laguna Seca and the unfortunate accident that ended Bubba Chobert's career. It was mentioned it was Daryl Beatty that was doing the burnout between 5 and 6, when it was actually Kevin McGee that was doing the burnout between 5 and 6, and Bubba collided heavily with Kevin's bike. And it was 1988, not 1979. That's a big difference. As 88 was the first year the 500 GPs came to the US, and I was 13. But I remember it. I can see it. I remember the Chobert incident well, and it being reported on in Motorcycle News over here. So, yeah, I was well into GPs back in the late 80s. Some of the listeners maybe would suggest that I've never been into GPs, but, you know. So thank you for Jeff for writing in on that one. motopod@motopodcast.com. On to a little bit of racing reviews now. So let's get on with World Superbikes.
Yeah, let's have a spin through. We had round 8 of World Superbike from Laguna Seca, We had some local interest. We had, obviously, Moto America was also running rounds there as well. So the former AMA Superbike champ Josh Herron was there as a wild card. Jake Gagnier as well was there, and PJ Jacobson, who are already on the World Superbike grid. Josh Herron had quite a busy weekend because he was pulling double duty, not just riding World Superbikes, but he was also taking part in the Moto America Superbike race on the Attack Performance two-wheel legal Yamaha. So from 2017, from what I remember, not unsurprisingly, a Kawasaki track. Last year, Tom Sykes was on pole, and then we had Chaz Davis and Johnny Ray taking a win each for the two races. Potentially, I think we were looking to see the same, given Johnny Ray's and Kawasaki's dominance. I think going in, we were expecting to see the Kawasaki's, but we were hoping that Chaz and Marco could find a bit more form this weekend on the Ducatis and give them a little bit of run for the money. I mean, when you look at the championship going in, Johnny Ray is far and away in the lead. So now sort of scrapping over finishing places. So we've got Chaz is 70 points behind. 20 points behind him was Mark Vandermark. Tom Sykes is another 10 points behind, and Alex Lowe's in fifth. A few other names, you know, still, I looked down, I was, you know, looking at Eugene Laverty, you know, 73 points for the Aprilia versus 295 for Johnny Ray. I mean, that's just depressing reading. Salvatore, 75, you know, so for Aprilia, they're looking to have a good weekend.
They are, and obviously Eugene missed a couple of races after his injuries at Buriram. But it's still a struggle of a year again for Sean Muir and the SMR team on the factory Aprilias. But the nature of the opposition, as we've said so many times, the domination of the Kawasaki and the Ducati just mean it's so difficult for everybody else to just scrap amongst themselves. And especially with the resurgence of the Yamaha as well, it's almost, as we get to the results, it's almost a lockout of the first six places when everybody's on song. The two Kawasaki's, the two Ducatis, and the two Yamahas. It's almost your top six lockout. I had high hopes for Chaz Davis. Chaz always goes well at Laguna Seca. He raced in AMA around the circuit. He's raced MotoGP around there. He stood in one year on the Dantin bike. That's what Neil Hodgson rode. He stood in on one of the Ducatis one year because he'd ridden there previously. And it just seems to be a track that suits Chaz Davis. As we said with the development of the Ducati, unfortunately, it just wasn't quite at the races this weekend. It was still strong enough for good results and to end up on pole. I think he was almost at lap record pace. But obviously they have the qualifying tyres there anyway. I was disappointed Chaz couldn't quite take it to that next level. But so during Super Pole, I think everybody was on a flight. They're flying last lap, but unfortunately, the only thing that was flying was Loris Baz at the top of the corkscrew. He'd been out for the full Super Pole 2 session, went out towards the very end to try and get at least a time in, and ended up throwing it in at the top of the corkscrew after two sectors, which in turn brought out the yellow, waved yellow, so everybody had to roll off. So those who were on the fastest laps, unfortunately, weren't able to take advantage of their last flyer. So it was pole position for Chaz Davis. So he didn't have a bad weekend, and we're talking him down a little bit. He actually had quite a particularly good weekend. But when you're up against the domination of Jonathan Ray and the Kawasaki, it's easy to miss the point of what Chaz achieved this weekend, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure. And also, that Super Bowl 2, it was clear that the Aprilias had found some performance. It was Laverty, essentially, who was leading the times there, even to run 2. When they came out back on run 2 with the soft qualies on, Laverty was straight back on it and, you know, bang in with a new fastest time. So it was only really in the last 9 seconds that Davis was able to just to push that a little bit harder, go top with Johnny Ray just behind. But, you know, you look at the qualifying times, I mean, the top, what, 6 are all within a second.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, it was really tight. Yeah.
Was really, really tight.
But I think, what did I read it, or did I imagine that those Aprilias have been, the frames have been stiffened a little bit more? or braced somewhere. It seems that they've made them a little more rigid.
It was difficult to figure out. So Laverty was interviewed, and they definitely said, "Oh yeah, we know this is the problem that we're having. We've made some changes, and it's made it a lot better." So of course, the question was, "What did you change?"
Yeah,
and he said it was something to do with the rear. And they said, "Okay, so what was it?" He said it was something very, very simple. Okay, so what is it that you've done? And essentially, like, they didn't, Laverty just basically wasn't saying what it is that they had done. But there was a sense that, you know, it's been there for a long time and they could have arguably have done it at any time, but now they just thought to do it. So I'm wondering if it's something as stupid as just lengthening the wheelbase or, you know, something like really dumb. Because to not talk about it, to not just say, oh, we tried a new suspension linkage, or, you know, we just tried a new swing arm pivot position or something like that. You know, I what's wrong about saying that? I have no idea.
It's not extra padding in front of the tank, is it?
I have no idea. So, and equally too, I couldn't see what it would be that his competitors would go, oh my God, we never thought about doing that. Oh my God, quick. And they will run it and do it and then sort of gain a similar advantage. But, you know, whatever it is, Laverty and to a degree as well, Salvatore were back in there and able to compete. So that was, from my mind, exciting because now we had the, not just the Aprilias up there as well, but now the Yamahas, Cameo as well. Still a decent seventh place in Super Bowl 2, which is really impressive because he literally jumped off a plane from Suzuka.
He did.
Where he'd been testing for the 8 hours. So he had no idea what time it was.
I don't think he actually knew where he was at most points during that weekend. He suffered with jet lag dreadfully.
Alex seemed to have the Yamaha pretty well dialed in. I think Vandermark was struggling because he had to go through Super Pole 1, which is unusual.
It is.
For him. He was able to claw up to ninth, but Alex definitely was the lead Yamaha there in fifth.
Alex has definitely got the bit between his teeth at the moment, hasn't he? He's banging in some really good results off the back of his maiden win. So he's carrying that momentum forward, and he's now getting to the point where he's disappointed if he doesn't make it onto the podium, which is great to see for Alex. He's plugged away since he moved up from BSB, and it's very fitting that he's finally finding his feet, and especially having quite, you know, Michael Vandermark comes with an awful lot of pomp. He is Magic Mike. He is the next big thing, and for Al to step up to the mark on that one, he's outperforming Michael Vandermark on a reasonably regular basis. Although, you know, Vandermark, obviously he had his successes at Donington Park, but it seems that certainly during qualifying and in recent races that Al seems to have the measure of Vandermark at the minute.
Yeah, agreed. I think Alex, for me, has always had, you could see he's got all the different elements, all the different components. You would see the speed, you'd see the qualifying, you would see the passing. And he seemed to just struggle to pull it all together in a consistent package that he could deliver all together on race day. He seems to have pulled that all together now, and there's just a maturity about how to go about, riding a race. I know he'd been previous years, he's had that reputation of crashing, but this year it's been completely different. I mean, he's one of the few riders, I think, that have pulled points in every single round, and, you know, he just rides so maturely and so assured now. And yeah, you're right. I think over the race distance, he's a faster rider than Vandermark. He's definitely got the pace on him.
And also both in the same team at Suzuka as well, alongside Nakasuga.
Yeah, and did you see the livery for that bike?
Oh, my days. Doesn't it look fantastic?
Doesn't that look fantastic?
The 20-year throwback to the YZF R1, and it looks amazing. Suzuka, just a slightly off-topic, Suzuka always throws up fantastic liveries, but also it throws up fantastic lid designs. It's always something. Ladies and gentlemen, keep an eye on social media, on the various outlets, because there are some stunning designs and there are some stunning lids, whether it be Shark, Arai, Shoei, wherever. It's a great time of year for liveries that make you go,
Okay, so Michael was ninth on the grid. with Chaz, Tom, and Johnny Ray on the front row. And it was an interesting race from the standpoint that it was a very, very hot track temperature. And I think as the race went on, we started to see that this was catching out some of the different riders, because quite a few people went down. Even right from the start, Salvatore is one of the early fallers, unfortunately. He lost the front, and then Baz went down. And I think actually Salvatore, after getting going, went down again.
He crashed twice. He did.
Yeah.
Which is always a feat in itself, really. I always find that quite impressive when riders do that. Although, to be fair, it's almost expected if you've had a crash once that something isn't quite right with the machine and you end up crashing again.
Quite possibly. But we'll see, like, as the race went on, unfortunately, I think a lot of people were struggling with the hot temperatures and especially with the front. But it was Davis into an early lead with Ray and Sykes following. And, you know, from the standpoint, I don't think there was much surprise in watching Davis trying to hold off Johnny Ray as long as he could, but pretty quick. Davis made a little mistake, ran wide, I think, into the entrance of the corkscrew. Ray swept through, and then he was just off. Literally.
Never to be seen again.
Never to be seen again. So, you know, you've got Davis, you know, he was gallantly trying to stay with Ray, but you could see, like, Ray just puts the hammer down and just starts almost doing like a Lorenzo-esque. I think his race pace was about 124 every single lap.
It was, and it's you're exactly right with that phrase. It was absolutely Lorenzo-esque. When you look at his lap times, it was 24.5, 24.6, 24.5, 24.4, 25.6, 24.5, 24.6. It was just within two or three tenths for about eight laps. And he just manages it so well. And nobody has any answer to it. It's impressive to watch, in a sense, but it's difficult. I can't lie.
It's just demoralizing, you know. He's like, and that's like absolute race pace. I mean, anyone behind him is just trying so hard to even stay with him. The idea of trying to pull out like half a tenth, you know, like half a second, sorry, on them to close him down and actually have some pace to get past him.
And he's not really making mistakes either. This is, you know, if you're relying on him to make a mistake, you're relying on the wrong guy. So, yeah, he swept away to the win. Well-deserved, well-ridden, and all the credit in the world to Johnny Ray for that. As you say, gallantly hanging on to his coattails was Chaz Davis. So, you know, even though he didn't make it to make the win, he sort of backed up his pole position with second step on the podium. The one thing that I kind of marvelled at and was also sort of like in awe and a little bit scared at the same time, how hard was Alex Lowe's pushing for that third place, considering he actually had quite a gap? Did you see that?
It's hard to say. I don't know if he was just managing the gap.
Managing the gap. He looked ragged. He was really trying.
And to close the gap on Davies?
Yeah. I think whether he misread his lap board and just kept trying rather than settling for the points. But yeah, the bike was out of shape. He had a foot off at one point. And yeah, it was like, geez, Alex, you're like, breathe, son. Breathe. You're all right. Just bring her home. Just take the podium.
He seemed to have, like, unfortunately, a fairly lonely ride there in third.
Which Sykes, made me wonder why he was trying so bloody hard.
Yeah. Sykes just slipped backwards. I mean, after Lowe's went past him, he just sort of gently went backwards. And I think, you know, Forres was catching him there and sort of that pushed him down into sixth. And then I think Melandri was coming after him in the closing laps.
Yeah, and Eugene Laverty as well was still in the mix after his, pretty decent showing in qualifying. He qualified fourth and finished the race in fourth place as well, which put him on pole for race two.
And I think that was Aprilia's highest finish at that point.
I would say it was, and I would venture to suggest that it might be SMR's highest.
Yeah, and it was a nice return. You know, Sean Muir is a very personable person, and I think you really got to appreciate the work and dedication, the professionalism they put into the teams and bringing that Milwaukee Aprilia to the track. I mean, the whole presentation of the team and the livery and everything just looks fantastic.
I think they've finally arrived as a world superbike team after they had their little delve into BMW, which didn't come off, unfortunately. The Aprilia is working now. They're getting it right. Whatever didn't work last season is working this season for certain. So as you say, it's kudos to Sean and his team up in Gisborough, up in the very northeast of England. Michael van der Mark, he was eighth. Not ideal, really, for him. Obviously, he struggled in qualifying. He struggled in the race as well. Torres was ninth, and Jake Gagne in 10th place, which was good for him. But I think that one of the biggest talking points of race one was Toprak's crash halfway down the corkscrew.
Yeah, it's such a shame, too, because I think he was up in about 10th.
Yeah.
And that was such an ugly high side. Partway down through the corkscrew.
Yeah, what a place to do it, because as you're going forward, you're getting higher. It's the same as crashing at Paddock Hill Bend at Brands Hatch. If you high side there, the track drops away, so the further forward you go, the further you fall.
And I think from him, from what I understand, like, you know, that compression just bottomed out the rear suspension. And then as he got back on the gas, there was just nothing there to take it, and the back slipped away.
It all unloaded. Yeah, exactly that. As the suspension unloaded, that was it. It was, it was a tough one, and it destroyed the bike.
And then some. Jeez, Louise.
I think they salvaged the engine.
I think that was the only thing they could.
One of those crashes, it pans to the garage, and obviously, you know, some of the team are looking at Toprak to make sure he's okay. Yeah. But his mechanics sat there going,
oh, God.
20 grand, yeah. 25 grand, 30 grand. And you're like, oh, wow.
Now, he was pretty lucky to come out of that accident than the bike. I mean, he was hurt, but broke a toe. But when you see the force and the violence of the impact, again, testament to the protective helmet and airbag suits.
It really is. Yeah. The riding kit these days is fabulous. And as you say, kudos to his kit. I'm not. This is the point where Harry will say, "Oh yeah, he races. He runs RI and he runs Alpine Stars." Which I think he might.
I think it's Dainese.
Oh, is he on Dainese? Okay. And it's probably Shuey. And it's probably Shuey.
Yeah,
I'm not
going to compete with on Harry on that.
But whatever kit he uses, the standard these days is absolutely incredible.
The other shame too was seeing Josh Herron, the wild card. You know, he was doing fairly well, but had to retire with five laps to go, and he was having really quite the time, because I was thinking, like, the super bikes are running on Pirelli, but I think Moto America bikes run on Dunlops.
Okay, interesting. Well, I suppose their bikes are set up for them, but they won't have such a performance.
Yeah, but the sense of, like, going from one to the other, especially over the races, the tire goes. But I think it sounds like he was struggling a little bit, and the front tire was causing him issues, and I think he was straining it. And he said he retired because he essentially was starting to get, like, back spasms or something. Okay. And his focus was really on the Moto America race. So, you know, he just he pulled out five laps to go just to make sure that he didn't hurt himself too bad for the Moto America race.
Which is always good to see the wild cards out. And if they are on different rubber, they're not going to, you know, worry the front guys too much. So it would be too much to ask to run two races on Pirellis and two races on Dunlops. Yeah. So. Yeah, good. And it's extra mileage for him as well, isn't it? But back spasms aren't nice.
So for World Superbike Race 2 on the Sunday, with the reverse grid lineup, we had Laverty getting to go off pole, Melandri and Fares on the front row, Tom Sykes in the middle there, Jordi Torres on the MV Augusta. And actually, it was good to see the MV. Like, he had a ninth finish in Race 1. There was a while there where I was worried that the MV, I thought, okay, you know, that's it. They've run out of money. The development stopped now. He's just going to have to sort of ride what he's got to the end of the season. But I think they've got a slight uptick in performance there. So, I mean, he's been doing some pretty impressive things, as did Leon last year with that MV.
Certainly.
So it was really great to see him sort of back there in the mix, like I say, going off row two. Alex and Chaz and then Johnny Ray in ninth were off at row three. So, as usual, part of this was just to watch how quickly can Johnny get through the pack and push his way to the lead. And it didn't take long.
It didn't, but it took longer than was expected, because he kind of got boxed out into turn one, didn't he?
Yeah, he did a little bit. But I mean, he was already up to sort of like fifth pretty quick. Sykes, unfortunately, again, struggled, had a terrible time off the line. I mean, he was already down to about ninth by lap two. But it was also Laverty off pole position, and he, you know, just took the bit between his teeth and had the pace and just ran with it. And it was him and van der Mark, I remember, with Ray chasing after them. So he, you know, was up to sort of third, trying to close down Laverty and van der Mark.
Yeah, and one thing that it, as we said already, it's so good to see Eugene at the front. He did it earlier this season. He'd shown the potential a couple of races ago where he led. He led the opening, I think, maybe two or three laps of a race and was making a break, but unfortunately crashed. And for the life of me, I can't remember where it was. It's just one of those things where just thinking off the top of my head at the moment.
But I think this is what they remedied. This is where he was saying, like, you know, we have decent pace, but we tend to lose grip at the back, especially as the rear starts to wear. And I think from what I understand, this is whatever the setting, this miracle mystery setting change was, this is what allow them to keep that grip throughout the length of the race, so he could still be competitive.
Certainly. And when you're on a bike that isn't performing and you're finishing sort of late top tens and DNS and things like that, it's easy to get carried away in the fact that you forget how good a rider Eugene Laverty is. And he is one of the top riders in World Superbikes. You know, he has the experience, he has the background, and he has the talent. And now the bike is working for him. We're starting to see the true Eugene Laverty come to the fore in World Superbikes. And as you said earlier on about the manufacturers mixing things up with the Yamaha Ducati and the Kawasaki, I think we're really seeing the RSV4 making those strides with Eugene on board. Because I think initially Savadori was outshining him a little bit, because he was the young guy in Aprilia coming through, and he was fast and he was the future. And it's taken Eugene a while to settle with the Aprilia and to help them develop the bike going forward. But I think now we're seeing almost a resurgence for Eugene Laverty, and I really hope that continues through this season, and hopefully if he stays with the team into next.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Salvatore is a good second rider. Unfortunately, he had another poor showing in race two as he crashed at the corkscrew in lap eight. So that was two.
He doesn't have the consistency, does
he?
No,
but I think he's shown he has got the pace. And I think you're right. With Laverty leading the development, I think the two of them together, it'd be interesting to see what happens next year. If Sean is able to negotiate a deal with to stay with the Aprilia, or if, as the rumours suggest, that they might be going or looking at a BMW tie-up.
Yeah, which, if after the effort they've put in with Aprilia and the steps that they are making, it wouldn't seem altogether right to jump to BMW, which they had the difficulties with when they first moved to World Superbike. Albeit it wasn't a factory BMW, there was no factory support. It was a customer BMW at that point. Maybe if... You know, obviously Sean knows what's best for Sean and the team, but I would personally like to see them continue with Aprilia and develop it, because they have Eugene as an X250 rider as well, and the smaller nature of the RSV4, it suits him and he can ride it. So I think he could certainly be a regular podium contender next season if they can keep taking that development forwards. But they are only a small factory team, and they're running the MotoGP project as well. And whether they have the resources at Noal to put a championship effort together, because obviously not since Max Biaggi have they sort of run towards the front. Leon Camier was too big for the Aprilia, and he had almost inferior machinery to what Max had. So it would be nice to have them on equal standings, and you know, to bring another manufacturer into the fray.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think part of the beef that Sean has with Aprilia is he essentially feels that all the money that he's paying to them is that's the development he's getting, that Aprilia themselves aren't really putting in development time necessarily. You know, it's not feeling like an equal partnership.
No.
So I think this is what he's asking for them, is to say, you know, look, we've proved we can run a team. We've proved that we can be successful here. If you want to carry on in World Superbike, you know, this is really, I think, the time for you to step up and start matching, some of the financial investment from that standpoint. I think the worry that I would have about BMW, and this is just how they've behaved previously, is BMW seem to use the World Superbike as a marketing exercise, which is fine, but they don't have long-term commitment there. So my worry is that they'd come for a year or two with the launch of their new bike, they would, you know, do as be as successful as they could, and they'll probably be wonderfully successful because I'm sure they'll cut a big paycheck for it. But my sense is that from that point they will just walk away. If you're the team running the BMWs, there's always that sense that at some point in the future you will start to lose that factory support. Where, you know, Aprilia, I think, have proven themselves that, you know, they've had quite a long time committing themselves to World Superbikes. And I know they're doing the MotoGP effort, but it sounds like, you know, they want to and will do run the two together.
True enough. And I think also the Aprilias are, that they're not the cheapest motorcycles to work with in terms of parts and in terms of build. I think the BMW is certainly easier to work on from a mechanics point of view. I remember talking to one of the SMR guys last year and he said they're beautiful things to work on, but they have such a short shelf life on some of the components that they don't have, because they're pure because they're basically purebred race bikes, aren't they? Yes, they are. They're a homologated model, but Aprilia are in the same vein as Ducati have over the last 20 or so years become synonymous with racing as purebred race bikes. Obviously Ducati have their street bikes as well, but the Aprilia don't really have that, do they? They have the Tuono, but you know, when I was a kid, you know, the exotic bike to have was the RS 250, or you had the RGV 250, the KR1S, whatever. But the you see an Aprilia RS 250 about and it's like, wow. And it's expensive, and you know, that does transfer into the race department. So, you know, as you say, we'll see on that front. As we go back to the racing, you know, Eugene led early doors. I think Eugene was second up until nine laps to go before Chaz Davis managed to sneak his way past. But, you know, congratulations to Eugene, to Sean and the SMR team. Eugene's first podium since 2014. First podium for Sean Muir in World Superbikes. If I stand to be corrected on that, please write in motopod@motopodcast.com. But off the top of my head, I can't think of one. Alex Lowes, he came home fourth ahead just of his teammate Michael Vandermark.
And that was a good fight to watch. I mean, you could argue a lot of race two probably wasn't really that interesting. But from sort of midway, watching Lowe's trying to find a way around Vandermark, that was really, because they were very, very similar pace, but you could tell Lowe's just had a little bit more speed.
He did. And he made it count when it mattered. So a good haul of points for Alex Lowes. A great haul for Chaz Davies, really. Pole position and 2 second place finishes. You know, that's 40 points. So for runner to chase for the runner-up spot in the championship, he's done himself plenty of favours this weekend.
Definitely a better weekend than his teammate, unfortunately, who crashed fairly early on lap four, I think.
Yeah, a weekend to forget for Marco Melandri. Very, very difficult. For him, Lowes and Vandermark fourth and fifth. Forres, Torres, Sykes fell away to eighth. He complained of setup issues for race two after he had a front tyre issue in race one. Jake Gagne, he came home in ninth place. I think his best finish of the season. Loris Baz in 10th. And I think that leaves Jonathan Rea now 75 points clear.
Yeah, that's right. There is more World Superbikes from Italy, two weekends from the 6th to 8th of July. That's from Misano. But I want to talk to you about BSB that was not the weekend just gone, but the weekend before from Snetterton.
Indeed. Hopefully the listeners are still awake.
Yeah, I know. That was meant to be a short review of World Superbikes.
It's like when Harry and I used to go, you look at the race, you go, well, that wasn't particularly exciting. There won't be much to talk about, so we can box that off in 10 minutes. And it's like, no, we can't, because we're enjoying ourselves, aren't we? I'm not on the show too often, so although I think this is twice in 3 weeks, something like that, so I'm going to make the best of it. And
it's just because of the running BSBs and the fact that, well, I like having a natter.
Me too. I still have one or two fans left out there who enjoy listening to my dulcet tones. I think one being my mum, who actually doesn't listen to the show, but she's still a big fan of mine. And obviously Jennifer as well, who listens religiously when I'm on.
So Snetterton was round four of the BSB. This is back from the long TT break. I was just linking back to Snetterton 2017. I think it was pretty much a clean sweep by Shane Byrne. But unfortunately, Shane, obviously after his accident, not here to compete. And it was Andrew Irwin picked as a replacement for Shane Burns' bike at Paul Bird Motorsport.
It was, and one that sort of made me take a sharp intake of breath, really. It was a surprise. It was a left field appointment. I don't think anybody really saw that coming because he's never ridden a superbike before. He's currently plying his trade with Simon Buckmaster's CIA Landlord Insurance PTR Honda squad after departing the British Supersport Championship at the end of last season. Obviously his brother Glenn Irwin is already ensconced within the team, based up in Carlisle in Cumbria.
Well, the thing I was just going to talk about, Andrew, I think one of the difficulties that any team owner, team manager faces trying to replace long-term a rider mid-season is all the riders you want
are
pretty much booked and contracted to other teams.
It's absolutely that. It's down to availability and which teams will let their riders go to a rival team.
And there does seem to be a bit of a gentleman's agreement that, you don't like hostilely pilfer riders. I mean, it can really upset some of these teams and their sponsorship deals and the other things that they've got in place. And then you have sort of a daisy chain effect where, they themselves then would have to find a replacement.
That's right. Yeah, it cascades down, doesn't it? So it's a difficult situation. I know there were a couple of riders that were approached for the PBM ride, but unfortunately weren't in a position to take it on. So they ended up at the door of Andy Irwin, who, if you're going to bring someone in, then yes, bringing in someone's brother is a fairly shrewd move because you know that Glenn is going to tow him round at every available opportunity. As far as I'm aware, that's exactly what happened, and why not? I think they were inseparable most of the weekend. They certainly had to be because I don't think that Andrew would have made the times on his own, having never, ever ridden a superbike before, and I don't think he even got a test in. He turned up wearing Glenn's spare set of leathers, which were relatively ill-fitting as well because they're slightly different in stature. But he improved every session. So, kudos to the fella for doing what he's done. It was a difficult task to take on. But when we look at the qualifying times, he made it into Q2, which was super impressive for a rookie rider. When you think back to last year, Josh Elliott and Andy Reid were on the Tyco BMWs, it was Josh's first time on a superbike. He didn't make it out of Q3. But for Andy Irwin to make it into 12th place in qualifying, it is, it's a feather in his cap, which was to be slightly ruffled in race one. But as we look into qualifying, the weather was, as has been the nature of the weather in the UK for the last maybe 4 or 5 weeks now, we've had barely any rain. Even in Lancashire, where it nearly always rains, and Manchester and that west side of the UK and Ireland, that's kind of the sponge for my side of the country. We're always reasonably dry on this side of the Pennines that go up the middle of the UK, or the north middle of the UK, should I say. But we've had fantastic temperatures, and that goes back to Snetterton and will hopefully hold out in a week and a bit's time for Knock Hill. So weather wasn't an issue all weekend. I think there were some reasonable surprises at Snetterton when you look at the pace of Josh Brooks and the resurgence of Jake Dixon, a return in Dan Linfoot. It was an interesting weekend overall, I think.
Well, I think part of the interest popped up before qualifying even started. One of the things I was really surprised to see, that Tommy Bridewell, about an hour before qualifying, got the telephone call to say that he'd been dropped by Halsall Racing.
Yeah, which... A strange move, in the world of BSB, where, you know, as Scoop Carter will always say at some point during the trackside commentary, expect the unexpected in BSB, and that was certainly unexpected, not least by Tommy Bridewell himself. There's been various stories that have come out since then as to what it was. It was down to fitness. It was down to something that was said during commentary that was taking it out of context. The true side of things, there's the Halsall Racing side, there's the Tommy Bridewell side, and there's the truth. Three sides to the story, I'm sure. And such is the nature of motorcycle racing, I'd be surprised if we get to the bottom of the true reason of why it's happened. Potentially it's none of our business, but as fans of the sport, we like to know. And I think it's Colin Wright making his mark, the former GSE, INS GSE and Groundworks Southeast racing boss. He, you know, successful championships. He took Troy Bayliss to the British Superbike title. He took Neil Hodgson to the British Superbike title. Leon Camier to the British Superbike title in 2009 on the Airwaves Yamaha. Colin Wright knows what he's about. Colin Wright knows racing. Colin Wright is he's not your archetypal BSB team boss. He is his own man. He will plough his own furrow. And if he doesn't like it, he will say. There's always been the picture painted of him by Dave Miller at Bike Sport News of him storming down pit lane. He has the rule book in one hand and a protest form in the other. And that's Colin Wright to a T, and he's making his mark on the team without a doubt. And I think most people saw it coming, but certainly not at that level, that he was going to make waves and ruffle feathers, but to actually pluck a few feathers and scatter them across pit lane, it was something that wasn't really expected. So it was cited as results, and it was also in various places cited as fitness. But yeah, it was hard to take for Tommy Bridewell. As you say, half an hour before QP, you're just psyching yourself up to go out, and you're told your services are no longer needed. Usually that waits till Monday morning.
Agreed. I mean, I think that there was a real clash of personalities, and someone just got a bit emotional about it, because I think if it was any reasonable practical possibility, they would have, you know, with the whole team, everything in place, they would have run the event, and then, you know, I think it would have been announced Monday. Somebody just got a bit emotional, I think, and decided to pull the plug then. But that unfortunately wasn't the only news of riders parting company with teams.
It wasn't.
A little bit later in the event, we had rookie Carl Phillips revealed that he'd parted company with the Gearlink Kawasaki team after, he qualified last, but I can imagine it was just like collectively feeling that they're not making the progress they want to make. And then the other riders too announced a split was Carl Ride and the CF Motorsport Yamaha. I think he announced that Sunday after morning warm-up. And subsequently, I think he has gone on to social media to say that he's going to be taking a break from racing. I think he was saying like he's just not enjoying it, and he's conscious that his family especially are putting a lot of money and support into this, and he's feeling like he can't repay that in kind. So I think he's just going to take some time out for now.
It's an awful lot of talent to be sat on the sidelines. And from my point of view, I think if he'd have stepped up to BSB with a different team, maybe the outcome could have possibly been different. That's no slight on Kyle Ride, and that's certainly no slight on Craig Fitzpatrick and his Yamaha team. Craig is primarily known for running a super tight super sport outfit, of which Kyle Ride was part of, I think both in Stock 600 and in Supersport. Craig put a fantastic R6 together. They had limited British Superbike experience, if any, and to have a rookie move up into such a competitive series with a team that don't have a wealth of experience of British Superbikes, either on setup, riding, and, you know, of knowledge to pass on to Kyle. They maybe would have benefited with a slightly more experienced rider. When you look at what Taran McKenzie's doing at McCam Yamaha, they have the resources and the time and the teammate to be able to bring Taran on. There isn't a huge difference in talent between Taran McKenzie and Kyle Ride. They are both super talented riders and a product of the British Superbike Championship through Moto3 and through Stock 6 and Supersport. So it's a difficult one for Kyle Ride. If he's not enjoying it, he's not, you know, maybe struggling to ride again, there may be a little bit more to it that he doesn't want to say. And it's difficult. Carl Phillips, potentially the same. He was on a Stock 1000 last year. And the Gearlink Kawasaki, by tradition, isn't quite the quickest bike in the world. They also have the Supersport bikes to contend with as well. And maybe, again, he's just maybe feeling he hasn't got the backing that he and the support that he needs to be able to compete further up the grid. And again, that's not a slight on Gearlink Kawasaki or on CF Motorsport. They're bringing in rookies, but they're just not able to take them forward and to develop them how they possibly might want to. It's kind of diplomatic answer, but you kind of know what I'm saying with that.
Yeah, no, I do. And it's interesting you mentioned Josh and Taran in the McCann Yamaha as well, because Josh had a nice bounce in form. I think he mentioned that they delivered a new engine spec,
yes,
which has given him a definite and clear boost in performance. I think we saw that over the weekend. And I think also too, from what I understood, there was some technical help coming across from the World Superbike team, probably with more sort of suspension and chassis setup, but they were helping Josh and Taran over the weekend. And like I say, for Josh, that really helped him have a good bounce and performance, which was good to see.
It is, because it's going to spice up the championship nicely. Nobody wants to see, well, apart from his team, obviously, and Dave, his mechanic, nobody wants to see Leon Haslam run away with it at the front. However, a little bit of competition won't go amiss. And I still think that Leon, yes, I think Leon is odds-on favourite to win the British Superbike Championship. His consistency this season is outstanding. So I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that he will be British Superbike champion at the end of the season. But I do think he'll have a fight on his hands from Bradley Wray and the resurgent Josh Brooks as well. So I think there's an awful long way to go in the British Superbike Championship just yet, and I think there's more stories to be told. But yeah, at the moment, Leon Haslam is the man with a target on his back. But unfortunately, he didn't quite transfer that recent form to qualifying. He could only manage the fifth fastest time.
Yeah, I was just looking at qualifying. You know, when I look at sort of like those who went out in Q1, probably no big surprise. It was a shame to see Gino Rea still struggling a little bit down there.
That's a similar principle to Kyle Ride and Carl Phillips. Gino's never ridden a superbike before. He's never ridden the UK tracks, and OMG Racing are new to the series. So he's in a similar situation to the guys behind him. But to qualify 19th, you know, it's step by step. He only missed out by, what, by 0.2 to Mason Law, so...
Yeah, it was very tight. I mean, the qualifying overall was very, very tight. I mean, I know it's like not sort of a super long circuit, but I mean, it's just a reflection of how competitive British Superbikes is right now, that, you know, 0.2 of a second can make a huge difference.
It can. So going through into obviously, we're losing out on a place in Q2. Gino Rea, Sylvain Barrier, Kyle Ride, Sean Winfield, Aaron Zanotti, and Carl Phillips. Not making it out of Q2 into Q3 were a returning Jason O'Halloran, who was returning from a broken leg sustained at Imola.
And he was still on crutches. See him hopping and limping around the paddock. And I think his teammate Dan Linfoot was back from injury as well, which was great to see.
And he was also back from a broken neck, yeah. So Jason, he was the last one to miss out, I guess, if you look at it in reverse order. James Ellison in 11th, Andrew Irwin, you know, that's a great showing for him in 12th place. Richard Cooper, Christian Iden, Taran McKenzie, ahead of brother Taylor McKenzie. Peter Hickman returning from the TT and having to recalibrate his brain to Snetterton. rather than the Isle of Man TT course. And Mason Law was the last one to miss out.
And if you do look at those Q2 times, I mean, you've got Bradley Ray, who in Q2 was top with a 147.2. I mean, you could sort of go down to, what, like 15th to still be in the 147s? So that's like 15 places covered by less than a second.
0.7.
Yeah.
Yeah, by 0.7. Snetterton's a good circuit for that. It's a rider circuit. There aren't many riders that don't like Snetterton in a similar vein, but for different reasons than a lot of. You'll not find many riders who don't like Oulton Park. But it's a little bit wider. It's got a little bit of everything. It's got ballsy corners. Yes, it's got some heavy braking, and it's got a super fast back straight. So it's got a lot of what the riders really enjoy the most. Going into Q3, in reverse order, Michael Laverty, he finished second in ninth place. Danny Buchan was eighth. Luke Mossy was seventh, as you rightly say. A returning Dan Linfoot for Honda Racing was sixth. Leon Haslam, probably disappointing for him. A middle of the second row start in fifth place. Jake Dixon coming into some form at Snetterton for the home round for the RAF regular and reserve Kawasaki team. Lee Hardy's bunch coming back from the Isle of Man, who they had Gary Johnson campaigning for them over there. Glenn Irwin, he was on the inside of the front row with a resurgent Josh Brooks and a finally in form Bradley Ray taking pole position. Bradley Ray 146.6, Josh Brooks 146.7, Glenn Irwin 146.8, which again reiterates just how close it is.
And that was a very, very impressive pole lap by Bradley Ray.
I was, yeah. He had to get his head down. He knew he had to bring out something special. And I think I remember him talking afterwards. He didn't think it was all that quick. I think his penultimate lap was, you know, it was there or thereabouts. But he's like, you know what? I'm just going to have to really, as they say these days, send it. And send it he did in fair fashion to take a pole position for Sunday's first race.
Yeah, I thought race one wasn't necessarily exciting racing, but geez, drama right from the start.
Yeah, absolutely. It really was. And this was the one thing that, after all his improvements through the weekend, after the lights went out, Bradley Ray, he led away from Glenn Irwin, Josh Brooks, Jake Dixon, Danny Buchan, Leon Haslam. They were the top six as we went through Richie's, which is turn one, into, I think, the Montreal hairpin is turn two, where the scary tree is that isn't quite as scary as it used to be anymore, because it's looking old and it's propped up with timber and things like that, and it doesn't quite have the same scariness that it used to have. Unfortunately, whether he missed his braking marker, whether he misjudged braking a British superbike Ducati with a full tank of fuel, Andy Irwin made a bit of a pig's ear at turn two, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I mean, you could see he was just carrying way too much speed in there. He was boxed in a little bit. I don't know from that standpoint if he just didn't have his reference points dialed in, or he just thought maybe he was still on a 600. But I think he arrived with a heavier bike going a lot faster than he calculated. And unfortunately, he ended up skittling. I think Laverty went down, Linfoot, O'Halloran, you know, two riders fresh back from injury, still nursing injuries on the bike.
Absolutely.
The last thing that they want to have over this weekend is to, you know, to have that exacerbated or pick up another injury. And unfortunately, both of them got caught up in that. So the safety car came out because O'Halloran was on the deck for a while there, needing attention.
Yeah, unfortunately, the crash had opened up his still healing injuries on his broken leg. I watched it back in slow motion just to see what the chain of events were. And initially, it was Andy Irwin that basically, as Dan Linfoot was turning in, he took him out. Andy Irwin took out Dan Linfoot. It was Dan that unfortunately took out Jason as a chain reaction. And then it was Andy Irwin himself falling from his Ducati that took out Michael Laverty as he ended up underneath Michael Laverty's Tyco BMW. But also within that, on the outside, Ellison, after the race, said he could see what was occurring on the inside. So he moved to the outside to let things unfold, as it is a bit of a flashpoint at Snetterton on the opening lap, is turn two, because it's heavy braking and it's a proper hairpin. So everybody's trying to find their best. It's four into one, which, as we all know, doesn't go. So James had given everybody room on the inside. Same with Christian Hidden. And everything unfolded in front of them, and they pretty much came to a dead stop, both Ellison and Hidden. So that it took them effectively out of the race as well. So, you know, it took six riders out of contention just about. So it was a difficult incident. But as you say, the safety car came out, which thankfully let Hidden and Ellison catch up at least to the back of the field. But then after that, it was the same guys that were front. It was Bradley Ray, Glenn Irwin, Josh Brooks, Jake Dixon. They said Darren Dixon then. That's his bloody dad. That's showing my age. Jake Dixon, Danny Buchan and Leon Haslam. Ellison, he was 11th by lap six, so he made some decent progress. The second big talking point after Andy Irwin's little misdemeanour was lap nine, Luke Mossy.
Yeah, this was the drama. I mean, this was really, you know, watching it from, I think it was the Eurosport coverage, there was this, I'm just trying to remember the order. I think, first of all, I saw a shot of Luke Mossy walking across the grass. So you're like, oh, shit, he's obviously come off. And then the camera angle cuts back to the end of the straight. And now you see his bike has gone into the tire wall. But you can see Luke is like hundreds of meters off.
Luke is back at the chicane at the end of the back straight. His bike has gone off at Corum's and the bomb hole.
So you're trying to figure this out. You're like, okay, well, I guess that must have happened quite a while ago. But why has he walked all the way from his bike across the track, across all that grass? Why didn't he? And then gradually you start to piece it together, because then you start to see these huge kind of grass lines, and you start to think, holy shit, hang on a second. And yeah, then I think there's an actual replay of that, and you realize, like, oh shit, he couldn't stop. He lost the brakes and the bike, he just had to bail, essentially.
The inertia carried the bike on, didn't it?
Yeah, and across the track, thankfully. And he himself was up, because that would have been, I think they were saying, like, you know, braking into there, you're hitting, like, what, 180 miles an hour or something?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. On the Bentley straight, certainly. I think it happened to, didn't it happen to Shane Byrne a few years ago on the Rizla Suzuki as well?
Possibly. Obviously, from my standpoint, given the fact that he was riding the Kawasaki, I couldn't help but think of Haslam in the final round of BSB last year.
But also what the factory Kawasaki guys have been dealing with sort of higher temperatures and heavy braking before they managed to cure it. So it's a difficult one to pinpoint, but it's one that that Jack Valentine's, the team manager's, come out and said that they are working, you know, with Brembo to try and find. There's no obvious reason why this is the problem. There's no obvious reasons as to why the brake failure happens. And I wonder, just out loud, if there is some connection with what happened with the factory boys' brakes. If you remember out in Buriram, at the end of, you know, the back straight there in the high speed circuit, that they were struggling to get the bike stopped, weren't they? After, you know, sort of long straights, heavy braking, that kind of thing. And if you, when Leon's failed, it was at the end of the back straight at Brands Hatch. When Luke's failed, it was the end of the back straight at Snetterton. So areas of reasonably heavy braking.
It's hard to say. I mean, I have a track bike, you know, which I do the maintenance on. So, yeah, like, and I'm not an engineer, but for my mind, there's a difference between a bike that's having brake fade or is having some sort of spongy brakes, you know, as the heat develops that you can't dissipate, either the fluid's boiling or, you know, there's issues with the pads, to out and out failure where you pull the lever, it comes back to the handles and nothing, you know, even after two or three pumps.
No, that's right. And you can't imagine anything more frightening for a rider at those speeds, and it's clearly a Brembo issue after what Jack said. There is no obvious reason for failure. There's absolutely nothing to do with the team. It's nothing to do with anything to do with JG Speedfit Kawasaki. It seems that all fingers are pointing towards Brembo, and it's an issue with the brakes themselves. Now, I don't know enough about it to be able to get into a deeper discussion. But it's something that clearly needs fixing, and I'm sure that Jack and the JG Speedfit team are working closely with Brembo to try and eliminate this from happening again. Because obviously we've got Silverstone later in the year, which will be a little bit cooler, I'm sure. Although Brands Hatch in October isn't exactly tropical. So it's something to keep an eye on for now. Again, whether we will get to know what the issues were, I possibly doubt it. But I would just rather not see it happen again.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think we'll ever find out. I don't think we ever really got a concrete answer to what happened at Lyon.
No.
Last year, and I don't think we're going to hear now. But I just I pray and hope that whatever it is, they find it, they fix it.
100%.
So that was not the end of the drama, though. I mean, that was lap 8. And, you know, we still had Ray in the lead until lap 10. He goes down.
He does at Agostini's, the left-hander. It's almost a hairpin. It's a tight left-hander on the infield. By that point, I think, by all accounts, track temperature was dropping away. And he just fell off the side of the tyre almost.
Do you think he was pushing too hard?
I don't know.
Do you think this is the inexperience where, you know, maybe someone else would have sort of known to just manage that lead?
Possibly. It's only his second year on a superbike. So, yeah, it's quite possible that it could have been a little bit of inexperience, because, you know, every time a rider or a racer gets on a motorcycle, they learn something. So, you know, he has a lot to learn as far as racing a superbike goes. So, yeah, it could have been something a little bit of inexperience. We'll see when we come on to race two about that. But yeah, that took, obviously, with the no restart procedure for British superbikes, that took Brad Ray out of the race, because he was looking pretty comfortable.
Yeah, which is why I didn't think he necessarily needed to be pushing quite as hard as he can, but I think maybe that just came down to his confidence and how good he was probably feeling with the bike, the fact that he probably, you know, felt he could push that hard. But that meant that Glenn Irwin inherited the lead with Haslam closing him down.
Yeah, he did, but it didn't last long, and I think it was only a matter of time, looking at the pace that Leon was working at. It was only a matter of time before Leon passed, and I think it was the end of lap 14 at the end of the back straight that Leon slipped up the inside of Glenn. Lap 15, then we went on to the battle for that was Leon. That was the race for Leon. Glenn didn't have an answer to him after that. He stayed in close proximity, but he just didn't quite have that that extra yardage to be able to retake the lead from Leon after he'd slipped up the inside of him. The battle between Jake Dixon and Josh Brooks was fabulous.
Yeah, that was good to watch towards the closing end. Just watching, I think, was it Brooks outbraked himself a little bit?
Jake Dixon did
on the second, on the penultimate. The runoff there.
Yeah, he ran off on the end of the back straight, but came back into it. He was all over Josh Brooks, and then he just managed to put it up the inside at Corum's and drop it over the nose into what used to be Russell's chicane, and is now just one corner at the end. And I just beat Josh Brooks on the drive to the line. So a podium for Jake Dixon before we head off to Knock Hill to the scene of his double win from last season. But, you know, good for Josh Brooks. That was his best result of the season in fourth place. And, you know, within touching distance of a race win, just 1.8 seconds back. Good result for Danny Buchan. That was a little bit under the radar with everything that had gone on during the race.
Well, him and Taron McKenzie, I thought, as well. You know, Danny in fifth there, Taron in sixth. Both of those, you were right, they were kind of rides that went a little bit under the radar.
And both their best results of the season, and best result, I think, for Taran on a superbike. And Danny might have had better results on the superbike in his previous forms in British superbikes, but great for him and the FS3 racing team. And Taran McKenzie showing his clear potential with the McCams Yamaha ahead of Peter Hickman. James Ellison recovered to 8th, Christian Idden recovering to 9th, Bradley Ray's teammate Richard Cooper in 10th, Taylor McKenzie on the Moto Rapido Ducati in 11th, Mason Law on the WD40 Kawasaki in 12th, Sylvain Barrier Gino Rea picking up 2 points in 14th, and Sean Winfield rounding out the point scorers. Non-finishers, as we said, Bradley Ray, Luke Mossy, Dan Linfort, Michael Laverty, Jason O'Halloran. O'Halloran, I normally can say that properly. Jason O'Halloran and Andrew Irwin. Fastest lap was Glenn Irwin, which will stick him on pole position for race two later on that afternoon. Indeed it did. Glenn Irwin was on pole from Bradley Ray, Leon Haslam, Josh Brooks, Jake Dixon, James Ellison, finishing where he did, but still posting the 6th fastest lap. So well done for James Ellison for rescuing something from the first race. Taran McKenzie, a great showing in 7th place. Taylor McKenzie, again, ahead of his brother in 8th. And Danny Buchan in 9th place. Andrew Irwin, he was given a 3-position grid penalty. So he started from 20th place, the very back of the grid.
And unfortunately, Luke Mossy didn't line up, and neither did Jason O'Halloran. Luke suffered a broken rib, I think, from that get-off in race one.
Yes, yeah,
and I'm
well beaten up.
Sure he was happy that it was only a broken rib, because, like we say, that was scary. And O'Halloran just set out race two as a precaution after his incident in race one. I mean, he's still recovering.
He's still on recovery. Hopefully he will be fit for Knockhill next weekend. He's back, obviously, in recovery now for that. He hasn't taken part in any of the testing so far. They've been at Knockhill, I think, yesterday and today. And the boys are out at Cadwell tomorrow. So he's not taking part in any of the testing. They're just focusing on getting fit, ready for the long trip up to north of the border by the middle of next week, ideally.
Yeah. So race two, I mean, it was a sort of a poor start for Haslam, unfortunately, with Ray into the lead. But I think Brooks quickly was showing his pace, and the fact I think he wanted to finish on the podium, especially after having just missed it by one spot in race one.
Yeah, definitely the start of Josh Brooks's season was Snetterton. He has unerring consistency, which is why he made it where he did last season. He's been steadily plugging away at the points so far. He's managed to salvage a handful of points at each race. But now he certainly seems to have the bit between his teeth, and that showed again right from the lights out. But it was fast starting Brad Ray that took the whole shot. Leon Haslam, managed to work his way to sixth place. He put a bit of a move on. Now, who put the move on who? Oh, Ellison put a move on Irwin. That was right. Ellison put a move on Glenn Irwin, pushed him both a little bit wide at the Montreal loop, which Haslam sort of slid through and was like, cheers, boys, thanks very much. But unfortunately, two corners later, it was James Ellison that tipped off in the same place as Bradley Ray did in race one.
Did you see what happened? I wasn't sure if clipped a curb or something, because he seemed to lose the front there, and I thought maybe he'd clipped something and that just lifted the bike.
Yeah, as we see from time to time in BSB and various other series of racing, just catching the engine casing on the inner curves, because such is the lean angle on the bikes these days. Yeah, he could quite possibly have just caught the engine casing on the curbing that just lifted the back wheel off the ground, and obviously pushes him out of the race, unfortunately.
And just hard to see his run of luck continuing.
Oh, he's just, I think, if there was ever a championship for the most unlucky rider in British Superbikes, Ellison would have so many titles by now. He'd put Shane Byrne to shame. Quite the most unlucky rider in BSB. I can't begin to understand how he manages to have such poor runs of luck. You know, a lot of time through no fault of his own, you know, he's not completely blameless, as any rider isn't. They all have their offs, because if you're not crashing, you're not trying hard enough. But yeah, again, his bad luck comes back to haunt him again after such a great showing in race one. But by half distance, Josh Brooks had taken over at the front from Brad Ray, Leon Haslam, Irwin Dixon was still there as well. But it was on lap 10 that we had another talking point. Glenn Irwin pops his B-Wiser Ducati up the inside of Bradley Ray. Bradley Ray tucks it back, but unfortunately, as he tucks it back, he loses the front and he takes out Glenn Irwin as well. So it's sort of disaster for Bradley Ray, crashing twice in two races in exactly the same place, but this time taking out Glenn Irwin, who was none too impressed, as you can imagine. There were various gestures and hand waving and arms aloft and the old coffee bean sign being thrown forward. So yeah, not a great weekend for Bradley Ray before he headed off to Suzuka for testing. But then that left a group behind them, Danny Buck and Dan Linfort, Hickey, Michael Laverty, Richard Cooper. They were in a great battle for sort of the mid top 10 placings, which was good to watch. Great to see Pete Hickman getting his eye back in after the TT. Josh Brooks already seems to have his eye back in. And obviously, as we said, Dan Linfort returning from injury. Leon Haslam, he took the lead from Josh Brooks on lap 14 going into the ridiculously fast turn one. It's a bit more deceptive. It's quite, it was quite flat into there. I think gone are the days where if you got it wrong, you ended up in the cabbage field just outside of Richie's, because there isn't actually a catch fence on the outside. The runoff was straight into the farmer's field. Such was the nature of Snetterton race circuit. Then it became a three-way dogfight, Haslam, Brooks and Dixon. They were sort of the class of the field, some 9-10 seconds ahead of a chasing Dan Linfort. But the last lap, one of the best last laps we've had for a while, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, like you say, when Haslam went through, it looked like Brooks just didn't really have the tyres to go with him. And then it was just watching Dixon close in from behind. And I mean, he had incredible grip still, because he was taking huge lumps of time out the front two to ultimately catch up. And then, you know, Brooks, who had been fighting for first, is now fighting now to keep second. And that final lap of all three bikes, and I mean, I think, you know, Haslam definitely had the top spot, but, you know, the order, the second and the third was anybody's. And that that sort of like last that last move by Brooks and Haslam as they came out of the chicane for the line, oh my goodness,
it was, and it was a proper battle. And there was nothing, it was racing, there wasn't anything dirty or too deliberate involved in it. But as Haslam and Josh Brooks went for the line after they came out of Richie's, they came together. It was an almighty collision, really.
Yeah, I think Brooks had miscalculated there slightly. I got the sense that obviously, I think Haslam knew what Brooks was going to do. So Haslam sort of took the slightly different line so he could cut it back and get the acceleration.
Yes.
With Brooks slightly ahead. And I think maybe Brooks just didn't quite appreciate the acceleration Haslam had got coming up from behind. Because I think where he thought he was drifting across to close off the line to block it, don't think he realized that Haslam was actually literally alongside him.
He'd got great drive, hadn't he, on the outside there. And as he came across, as you say, and it's an uphill run to the finish line at Snetterton, and they kind of used all the left hand side of the circuit, whereas the line to the finish as you come out of Russell's comes back across to the right hand side of the circuit. As you come out of the left hander, you run out to that right hand side, and you tend to stay that side as you head up the start finish. And as it bends around slightly to the right further, you can tend to hug that right side line. But yeah, as they both drifted out across the track, they came to an almighty collision. It could have ended badly for the pair of them. We're thankful that there was no points lost, no positions, and thankfully no injuries, because that's a fast run up to the finish line.
Well, I think Josh did lose out through that, unfortunately, because Jake was able to sneak through and take second.
That's right. Yeah, he lost out in position, but he didn't lose out in injury or bike damage or whatever. But yeah, due to the collision, he lost the drive to the line, and with just 1.3 seconds just shy of covering the top three at the line. That just shows just how tight it was. Jake Dixon missing out on the win by 0.04 four of a second. As Leon Haslam takes a double, his fifth win in succession in British Superbikes 2018, and Josh Brooks a further 0.089 behind Jake Dixon. So a third and a second for Jake Dixon, a fourth and a third for Josh Brooks, two wins for Leon Haslam.
Who would have been very happy, because Snetterton was not traditionally a track he goes well at.
No, it isn't, and that's something that was... a real feather in the cap for Leon over the weekend. He's never really shown that well at Snetterton for whatever reason. But to come away with a double, I think, is more than he maybe expected after the results of recent years. But I'm sure he and the team had a game plan, and that game plan worked particularly well. Let's have a look. What have we got? So, yeah, two fifth places for Danny Buchan. Tip of the cap to Danny Buchan and FS3. A fourth place for Dan Linfoot. In race two was outstanding, coming back off injury. I can't believe the look that Jason O'Halloran hasn't had on his return from injury. Hopefully he will be back and fit-ish for Knock Hill. That's going to be a difficult one because they don't get an awful lot of rest there. So he's going to be, there's a lot of work for two 30-lap superbike races around the Knock Hill circuit. Yep, Leon Haslam, he's got the bit between his teeth. Let's have a look at the points table. He sits pretty at the top on 165 points ahead of Bradley Ray. So it's a really bad weekend for Bradley Ray. It'd be interesting to see how he mentally comes off the back of that. It was his worst weekend of the year after a double win of second place. Off the boil a little bit over the last three races, but a double DNF is a dint in his championship challenge, because he's missing out on podium credits at this point. As we look at the podium credits, which obviously do come into play after Silverstone, my apologies, on the 9th of September, Leon Haslam already has a 15-point lead over Bradley Ray when we go into the showdown sector. Shane Byrne's still there in third place. Obviously, that's going to drop away as the season progresses. We won't see Shane back at all this season. Jake Dixon, he's in fourth place. Glenn Irwin in fifth. Josh Brooks making a climb up the table. He has a crucial podium point ahead of Jason O'Halloran. Danny Buchan, he's climbed well. Christian Iden, the factory BMWs, not quite showing as well as you would hope they would, and trying to mix it up with the guys at the front. There's still just something, I don't know what's quite missing on the BMWs at the moment, but they're not the podium potential that they really should be. Dan Linfoot, Peter Hickman, James Ellison languishing down sort of mid-table, a departed Tommy Bridewell, Richard Cooper. Every rider has points in the British Superbike Championship already this season. There's nobody yet to score. And Taron McKenzie is leading the battle of the brothers. He is, let's have a look, he's on 29 points, Taylor's on 13. So a decent gap between them. And all rounding out down at the bottom with Sean Winfield on 2 points.
Yeah, it's right what you said about the BMWs. You look at race two there, Christian Iden finished eighth, Michael Laverty in ninth. I mean, they were, you know, literally together. So in some respects, you kind of say, well, that seems to be the performance of the bike, for that particular race.
Yeah, and they have changed to Ohlins this year from KTEC. So that was supposed to be the step forward that they needed to be able to challenge for podiums week in, week out. I'm not saying they're going to walk away with the championship or be consistent race winners, but at least to be within a shout of the podium or within that podium group is nothing less than you would expect from the BMW Motorrad Tyco BMW squad.
Well, we've got more BSB coming up from Knock Hill. That's at the weekend following the 8th of July. That's going to be the same weekend we have World Superbike from Misano, Italy. We mentioned that we've got Suzuka coming up at the end of the month, but this weekend is MotoGP from Assen. Okay, thanks for your time. Anytime, looking mate. Forward to MotoGP this week. If you want to get in touch with us, don't forget you can always reach out via email. Hit us up at motopod@motopodcast.com. We're on the Facebook at facebook.com/motopod. You can also get in contact with us on Twitter. We have a MotoPod handle, which is @moto_pod. But if you want to abuse us directly, you can hit Dave up on Twitter at...
@DaveNeil, and also on my little sideline of @PaddockChatter.
Excellent. And I'm on Twitter @Andy_course. Hope you have a good rest of the week and catch up with you again soon. Thanks, Dave.
Cheers, Andy. Thanks, mate. And thanks a lot, everybody. Catch you soon. Bye-bye.